It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. Lori Skelton joins us to share her experiences using a new and unusual ingredient in classic desserts.
First, though, documents released yesterday indicate that prosecutors in a John Doe investigation believe that Governor Scott Walker was orchestrating a sweeping fundraising and spending effort to help him and other Republicans survive the 2011 and 2012 recall elections.
Those documents have kicked off a heated round of reaction across the political spectrum and captured some national attention as well.
And with us to discuss this is Daniel Bice, a political columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Watchdog column. Thanks for joining us today, Daniel.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. I want to start out. The documents yesterday, of course, indicate that prosecutors suspected Governor Walker and maybe some of his colleagues of orchestrating an illegal fundraising effort. In your estimation, as someone who has not just been following the story but working on it, what was the big news from yesterday? And beyond being interesting or titillating, what's its value?
There was a complaint filed, by one of the targets in this case back in February, trying to stop the investigation. And most of the complaint had been made public, and other elements of this have been made public. What was new yesterday was the prosecutor's response. The prosecutors responded by saying, "We think we had a legitimate case. We were asking for subpoenas, and we are pursuing this case for a particular reason." But when they filed this back earlier this year, their response was completely redacted. So we had no idea the outline of their case. Yesterday, the judge opened up that entire document so we could see for the first time what they thought was going on during the 2011 and 2012 recall elections.
And so in that outline, the case, the documents seem to point directly at Governor Walker.
They pointed at three individuals. They pointed at Governor Walker and his chief campaign strategist, R.J. Johnson. R.J. has been a prominent Republican strategist in Wisconsin for 20, 25 years. And Johnson's top deputy, Deb Jordahl. Those were the three people identified. And then it also identified a couple of other organizations, including Governor Walker's campaign fund. And the point was they were arguing that there was a massive system to do a coordinated campaign in terms of fundraising during the recall elections. The prosecutors thought that what they were trying to do was illegal, that it would cover up the sources of the money that was being spent. And it involved as many as 12, maybe even more, conservative groups, and money would be shuffled among those groups. And when those groups would then do their get-out-the-vote efforts or when they were advertised on TV, you would see their names, but you wouldn't know who was actually behind it. Now, the targets, specifically Wisconsin Club for Growth, felt like what they did was perfectly legal. The response so far has not been to argue that this was not going on, as the prosecutors were suggesting. The argument is that what they did was not illegal.
And it's interesting, too. There was a flowchart that I encourage people to take a look at, published in the Journal Sentinel today, that outlines some of the complexity of this whole thing. And that's, you know, really for people who are trying to follow this, who aren't really following politics that closely, this is
right.
Confusing territory.
It is. I mean, even if you are following it, you know, last night when we were putting the chart together, I was trying to make sure all of the numbers were right and all of the groups were right. And, you know, the only familiarity some people would have with a few of these groups is that they ran ads. The Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Issues Mobilization, Inc. ran ads, but, you know, the people don't know much about that organization. But the key parts are that the governor and his main strategists are at the center of this thing to shift all this money around. It is a quite complex scheme, as the prosecutor said, or effort that was put together by the various individuals in this.
And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the governor's reaction. Yesterday, in a piece that you published, the governor was unflappable on the campaign trail. Today, though, it appears as though he may have gone on the offensive a bit. We saw him on Fox Friday or Fox and Friends this morning, heard him on some Milwaukee radio this morning, and there was an opinion piece published this afternoon.
Sure. And just for a little bit of context, there was this is a John Doe investigation, which is a secret, supposedly secret, not secret anymore, but a supposedly secret investigation in which they can compel testimony and all of these. And there was one John Doe investigation that was launched in 2010. And the governor, during the first John Doe, remained largely silent and at one point said that he trusted the prosecutors to do the right thing, that he knew them and thought that they would do the correct thing. And he wasn't charged. He had a couple aides who were charged and convicted, but he wasn't affected. Now, during this John Doe, which started in August 2012, and it became public in a piece that I wrote in October of 2013, the governor has said repeatedly that he cannot he can't talk about the investigation because anybody involved in it would violate the secrecy order to discuss this. Well, this all changed yesterday after the release of the records and the news of what they were looking at specifically. The governor talked to the media and he pointed out that two judges have found that the case laid out by the prosecutors was inadequate or out of bounds. And then today, he's gone very much on the offensive. They bought $250,000 in TV ads that are airing throughout the state, Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, and elsewhere, starting today. And then he was tweeting last night repeatedly on this subject. He was on talk radio in Milwaukee, and he's written a column on the thing, and he's gone on national TV with Fox and Friends. So this is a full frontal response to what is going on.
Well, thanks so much for your time. We'll have to leave it there, Daniel.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
We've been talking to Daniel Bice, a political columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Watchdog column. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. Time now for Food Friday. This week, we've got a special treat for you.
We tasked our own Lori Skelton with a huge food experiment. We asked her to incorporate a mystery ingredient into some desserts.
Lori joins us to share her experiences and advice. She's one of WPR's in-house foodies and a classical music host. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
It is a great pleasure to be here.
Well, you've been making desserts for the WPR staff for a few weeks now. We knew here on Central Time what the secret ingredient was, but it was a mystery to everyone else. Tell us about your mystery ingredient.
What we were using in brownies and cheesecake and cake frosting and sauce for ice cream was miso.
Miso. Now, I only discovered miso a little while back in my life. Give us miso 101. What is it?
This is a Japanese condiment, for want of a better word. You combine soybeans and grain, usually rice, but sometimes something like a barley or a millet, sea salt, and you let this ferment. You let it sit in a barrel, talk to itself for a little while. What you end up with is a very powerful, salty, umami paste. In Japan, it's used for sauces, for dipping vegetables in. It's very, very good for marinating fish. I don't know if you've ever had a miso marinated cod.
I have not.
But it shows up in restaurants more and more around the country. There's one restaurant here in Madison. It's one of their signature dishes, and I just love it.
So the miso we get, that we don't have to ferment our own. We can go buy. I've bought this. It's you just buy a bucket of glop.
It looks exactly like that, a bucket or a bag of glop. Miso comes in varying strengths, and it's usually referred to by the color. The palest is called a white miso. Get a little bit stronger, yellow or brown. The strongest, which is going to taste almost beefy, is referred to as a red miso. As you get stronger, you're also getting saltier. I started using miso a little over a year ago when it was suggested that it be used as part of a vinaigrette for a particular vegetable salad. And it's now become my go-to salad dressing, ginger and miso and a little bit of oil and vinegar, and it's amazing.
You've said a lot of foods that miso could be used in, but what you're trying here is miso in dessert. Where'd that come from?
I was given an article that was published in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago. And the idea here is, if you've ever played with salted caramel in desserts, a lot of people are really enjoying the idea of sweet is more than just sweet. There are levels of flavor to it. You can add salt. You can add umami to chocolate or to things with cream. Sometimes, for instance, raspberries with balsamic vinegar. Sometimes you want a more savory element with fruit. And this particular article in the Wall Street Journal was saying, go miso on all of this. I must admit, as much as I love umami flavors, I was a little bit skeptical. So I thought this would be a great thing to try out with all of the different people at Wisconsin Public Radio, get a lot of different tastes involved, and see if this really does work.
So you put on your mad scientist coat, went into the Laurie Skelton Laboratory, and the first thing that emerged were the brownies. I've been able to taste all of these as you've done them. So the brownies, I'll say, I think were my second favorite of the bunch. I thought it worked well. Tell us about the miso in the brownies.
Well, here you had some leeway with the brownie recipe. Most of the recipes that I was looking at said use the mildest miso possible. The brownies, we were talking bittersweet chocolate and a lot of it, and it was suggested that you could go a little bit stronger miso. In retrospect, I think that was the wrong way to go. Most people found the umami brownies pleasant. Some people said tangy, and while it was a good flavor, I thought, it definitely took the gooey, gooey sweetness out of the mix. But some people really, really missed that. I don't know as I would use this particular brownie recipe as my go-to recipe for a brownie. But where I would love to try it is if I knew I was making a pan of brownies to use as the base for a brownie sundae. You've got this lovely, complex flavor, not too sweet, even though the chocolate is still there. And these brownies baked up more of a cake rather than something a little gooier. So this would be a great base to soak up ice cream and sauces and whatever you want to throw on top.
Okay, experiment number two, a box chocolate cake, and then the buttercream frosting had miso in it, right?
Right. Here I thought, okay, if miso is an element in your desserts, sometimes you just don't have time to do things from scratch, but you want a basic box cake to taste a little bit better than a basic box cake. And here I found a good basic buttercream frosting. I tried it two different ways. The first time it was just butter and sugar and miso, and that came out a little too thin, I thought, for a cake. I did, however, try that sweeter miso butter on muffins the next day straight out of the oven. Oh, heavens, that was tasty.
Okay, I didn't get to try that one, but that's okay.
Let's put it this way. I ate the whole
batch. It didn't survive.
It didn't make it out of my kitchen. It was really, really good. So thicker buttercream, one that you'd actually add eggs to and a few other ingredients. This one held up pretty well with the miso. The texture came out a little grainy, so you're probably going to have to play with how long you actually beat it in your mixer. But this was one that people thought, okay, I'm still getting this tangy. I'm still getting this kind of an aftertaste that I'm not quite sure I like, but it definitely took the bitterness out of that box cake. It definitely made the box cake taste better.
I thought that's the one where it was what I expected. I thought if you add miso to a dessert, it's going to taste salty. I thought the frosting tasted kind of salty. It wasn't quite, I don't know, it was weird to have salty frosting.
Well, the one thing that we don't quite know how to work with on a Western palate is this is fermented. I've gotten to love making kimchi, but that's a fermented condiment that I'm still learning how to use. And I think we've got the same element here. Because this is a fermented food, there are going to be flavors that we're just not used to. And I definitely was picking that up as I was working through these recipes.
Well, now we're all used to sauerkraut on our brats. We get our fermentation
yes,
in there a little bit.
But when was the last time you put sauerkraut in a red velvet cake?
Well, funny story. Okay, never. Okay, and now we're moving back up on my ranking list to the last couple. A cheesecake, raspberry puree, I think it was. And then where did the miso go into that one?
Miso went right into the body of the cheesecake along with all of the cream cheese and the sugar. Now, cheesecake is wonderful, but it can be a little bit heavy. And in using raspberry puree mixed all the way through the batter, you would have had the sweet element, but it still would have been heavy. By adding the miso, you lightened the cream cheese mixture so that the texture in your mouth was not leaden, but the flavor complexity was really starting to build with that. Again, you're working off some of the sugar versus the salt. Mm-hmm. You've got the fruit in it, which, you know, you don't normally think of salting raspberries, but it really was pleasant. It made the raspberries taste brighter. And again, normally for something like that, you'd be adding more sugar. This cheesecake had less than a cup of sugar in it. I was really impressed.
Okay. And what was the response? I mean, you heard my response. I liked it.
Most people, again, not everybody was thrilled with this. The word tangy kept coming up. Everybody was asking.
I don't see that.
When I hadn't revealed the secret ingredient, people were thinking sour cream, goat cheese. Did you use vinegar? Somebody asked me.
What?
Again, this, I'm not going to make this my go-to recipe mm-hmm. for a cheesecake, but if I know that I'm going to be making a cheesecake, say that's going to be part of a dessert buffet mm-hmm. where there's going to be lots of different sweet things, the idea that this is lighter in texture but still delivers a great amount of flavor would make this an option.
And now the winner, my favorite, you just brought in, and this is the easiest one to make, it sounds like, a butterscotch sauce with miso in it. We just put that on some ice cream. You cut up some bananas for us. Tell us about the butterscotch sauce.
A good caramel has, again, those complex layers of flavor. But making caramel at home can be a little bit daunting. This gave you all of the complex flavors that caramel has, but this was so easy. You whisk a little cream and butter in a saucepan until everything melts, throw in some miso and a little brown sugar, whisk it for 10 minutes, and you've got something that would just make anything. Again, ice cream, bananas. Somebody wants me to try it on cherries. It just sang. It was so lovely.
And we're posting this one over at the Central Time Facebook page. It's easy to make at home.
So it came together in less than 20 minutes, and you've got something. Again, the salt here the tangy was taken out of it, but you've still got that salt. You've still got that umami. It's exciting to eat it.
And did everyone else like it as much as I did?
Absolutely. This was the clear winner. Nobody had anything bad to say about this.
So were people's jaws dropping on any of these when you told them when they found out it had been miso all along?
Everybody was stunned, especially people who don't normally think of anything Japanese moving onto an American table. It was a really great mix in a lot of different ways.
So any lessons learned here that you want to experiment with in the future or apply to future desserts?
If you are going to be using miso in desserts, definitely stick with what is called shiro miso or white miso.
That's the mellower one.
This is the mildest one there is. And go slowly. You can always add more. Mm-hmm. But this is a flavor that if you add too much, you're not going to be able to dial it back. So if you've got a recipe or you've got a suggestion, I would say start with maybe 3/4 of what the recipe calls for. And then if you want a little bit more, bump it up.
And do you dissolve the miso in water first and then pour it into a batter? Or just take the glop and stir it in?
Glop it right in.
All right. So you give the thumbs up overall. Miso in dessert, it has a place.
It's definitely an element to play with. Again, I wouldn't call it the go-to, but if you want to change things up in the kitchen, this would be a great place to start.
And that's a great place to leave it. Lori, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies. You can find her recipe for miso butterscotch sauce on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're checking it out, maybe suggest a new mystery surprise ingredient that she can try out. Gene, anything you want to see make its way into an unexpected place in the food world?
No, I'm going to say I'm very open to almost anything because the weeks when Lori is working on these experiments around Wisconsin Public Radio, It's a great place to be.
Yeah, we get to be the lab, the testers.
Yeah, we're the lab, so suggest away. Post some suggestions on the Central Time Facebook page, and we will be happy to be the in-house testers for you.
And Gene, with all the cooking you do, you're gonna start putting miso in virtually everything you cook, right? And statistically, I'm right.
A glop. I'm going to be putting glop in everything I cook.
In the zero things you cook, all will have miso.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up, the group All Aboard Wisconsin is pushing for more passenger trains throughout the state, starting with the Chicago to Madison line.
That's not why we're playing that music. Mm-hmm. On this day in 1975, shark attacks hit theaters across the country with the opening of the movie Jaws. In addition to cleaning up at the box office and picking up a few Academy Awards along the way, Jaws added a new concept to the movie world, the summer blockbuster.
Mike Mayo is with us now to talk about the impact of Jaws and the biggest summer blockbusters of the last 40 years. He is a longtime movie critic. His recent books include The Horror Show Movie Guide and the novel Jimmy the Stick. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This is one of my favorite subjects.
Well, good, because we've got a full half hour to talk about it. I want you to talk about those dark days before the summer blockbuster. What was it like, and how did the world change movie-wise after Jaws?
Well, first, there was no internet then, so we kind of sat around by candlelight watching television, and nobody had VCRs then either, so it was just like, you know, this was a world that I know today's young people simply cannot imagine. We didn't carry phones around in our pockets either. What Jaws did was just to show that you could make a movie that was not meant to do anything but entertain, and to entertain very well, and have that really be the thing that everybody went to. Now, what we tend to forget when we talk about Jaws particularly is that it was an adaptation of a very popular novel. Peter Benchley's novel had really just been a huge bestseller. Almost everybody read it, and the studio was taking a pretty big chance when they gave it to Steven Spielberg. He didn't have that good a track record then. He was a young director. They ran into all kinds of problems because they actually made the film on the ocean instead of doing it in a tank or in a studio with a tank. And then they had the famous problems where Bruce the mechanical shark didn't work. And even now, when you go back and look at it, some of the scenes with the mechanical shark are pretty funny. I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, this is not a real shark. But that doesn't matter, because by the time we saw all of that in the movie, everybody was so scared. We were out there on the water in that boat with those three guys, and anything that happened beneath the surface of the water, we couldn't see, and it was terrifying us. That's what made the movie so suspenseful and why people liked it so much. And I can recall myself going back to see it two or three times that summer. That's just the kind of movie it was. People stood in line to watch it. That was just, it was part of the experience, I think.
Well, part of what it changed was marketing, I think. Let's give a listen to part of the Jaws trailer.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws.
So, Mike, I understand there's a big marketing push leading up to the movie's release on this day back in 1975. Did they change the way movie marketing happened?
I think that's it. I mean, this was kind of an all of your eggs in one basket thing. They were really betting a lot on this movie. They knew they had people interested in it, and so that they really wanted to get people into the theaters, and boy, did they ever. And we cannot go one more second without mentioning John Williams' music, because without that music, that hokey advertising there just would not work at all. But when you've got that score going on underneath it, then you can get away with baloney like that.
We're going to hear a lot of John Williams behind some of the clips we pulled for this show, by the way. Is that the sign of a blockbuster, John Williams did the score?
It has come to that, hasn't it? That's another one of my things. Another one of my favorite summer music movies is another one that he and Spielberg did together. We'll talk about that a little later. But it's just he really has the right touch. He knows what he's doing with this kind of score.
So do you think that the movie industry was surprised by the success of Jaws, or was this part of a larger plan? And then how did they react after that? You know, you got this monster hit, no pun intended, and then all of a sudden you got next summer to look forward to.
Yeah, and I think that's when we really started seeing the studios aiming for a few movies like that. And it kind of culminated, it seems like it was really last summer, that it looked like there was a big blockbuster, a big special effects movie every weekend opening up. And when you have that many, I think the audience just can't accept it. Say the teenager who would go to see one, maybe two, big science fiction horror movies is not going to go to four of them. And that's simply the way it is. The audience just isn't there. And as we were saying earlier, with Jaws, there wasn't all that much competition. We didn't have very much cable television, anything like that. For visual entertainment, you went to movies, and that was the movie you went to see.
And this was movie as event, and so if you're saying if it's diluted by having an event every week, it's not an event anymore.
Exactly. And part of it, I really do think, it's not just the movie. It is the whole idea that everybody's going to see it. This is something that everybody does. And the whole entertainment landscape is so much more diverse now. I don't think one thing can actually, you know, attract that much attention. The only recent thing I can think of that came close to that was James Cameron's Avatar, which wasn't a summer movie. That was released in the winter, of course. But again, you know, he made this big event movie there, but it takes something that special to do it. Can you feel the same kind of excitement for any of the Transformers movies or, say, Captain America movies, anything that's coming out this summer? No, it's just not there.
Well, here's a clip from a movie that stands as my big event movie of my childhood.
Mos Eisley Spaceport. You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
Star Wars, of course, and there's Sir Alec Guinness. And listening to that, he was probably the best-known name in that movie, along with maybe Peter Cushing. There wasn't that kind of star power that was going to single-handedly draw people in. So a blockbuster, at least at that point, didn't need the superstar actor to make it.
No, and by the way, you played my favorite line from that.
Mine too.
But yeah, and Star Wars, I remember with it, there had been an awful lot of talk about it. There had been a lot written about it while it was in production. We'd seen a lot of stills and things, and to get acquainted with the whole idea that we had a big space opera, but it was going to be treated seriously. You know, this isn't just a kids' movie kind of entertainment stuff. It is fun, but it is also meant to be taken seriously. And that's what I think the presence of Alec Guinness gave them.
Yeah, he gave that a certain gravitas. Mm-hmm. But boy, it still had that action that if you were in the mood to just go enjoy a movie and be swept up in it, you could easily do that. And I did do that back in the mm-hmm. theater, I remember.
Yeah, me too.
And this introduced, I mean, Jaws 2, I guess, part of one of the themes here in the blockbuster, the big special effects movie.
Yep. And the big special effects sequel, which is never as good.
You know, another thing that happened with both of these movies, and I'm thinking of it now, is they both became part of the culture. Like with the Jaws movie, everybody was scared to go in the water. If you lived in, you know, Lake Superior, you were afraid to go into the water. And then all the sort of the lampooning of it. I remember the land shark on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they just became such a big part of the culture. And it happened very, very quickly. And as you said earlier, everybody was so unified. Everybody was aware of it, no matter where you went.
Yeah, and it in any part of the country, it really was kind of a nationwide, and I would assume in Europe too. That I don't really know what the release pattern of that was, if it was out in other countries at the same time they didn't do that as much then as they do now. But it certainly was. This was something that, you know, everybody saw. And like I said before, most people saw more than once. It was something, it was just, you know, kind of the thing you did on the weekend. If you could go see Jaws again, you did.
That reminds me, one of my favorite calls on the Ideas Network ever was from a guy who remembered seeing Star Wars at age, I think, 11 in the Soviet Union.
Oh, wow.
With one Russian guy translating, doing the dubbing, and still being blown away by this piece of forbidden, illegal American culture. So, yeah, you're right, Mike. It had a worldwide sweep there.
So we move on to another movie, another big blockbuster, and let's play a clip from that right now. And I have to say, and I'm not going to do anything else except this is one of my favorite clips.
Uh-huh.
So let's listen to Harrison Ford.
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
Asps. Very dangerous. Go first.
So why did it have to be snakes? But again, I mean, a great movie, lots to look at, lots of action, and another summer blockbuster. So this trend by this time is pretty well entrenched in the movie industry.
Right. And I remember with Raiders, when that came out, I was living in a small town in Virginia and was friends with doing summer viewing, and I was friends with a theater owner, and she invited me over to a midnight screening of Raiders. This was a couple of weeks before it opened nationwide, and I only vaguely understood what this was. I knew it was from Spielberg. I knew it was science fiction or adventure or something, but that was about all. I had some vague idea that it actually took place in outer space. And then... And then to see this and just be so completely knocked out by this wonderful movie with the pace that just, you know, started fast and never let up the whole way through. Oh, that is one of my favorite movie-going experiences of my entire life.
We're talking to movie journalist Mike Mayo about the rise of the summer blockbuster as we celebrate the anniversary of the opening of Jaws in 1975.
Well, well. Jack Sparrow, isn't it?
Captain Jack Sparrow, if you please, sir.
Well, I don't see your ship. Captain?
I'm in the market, as it were.
You are without doubt the worst pirate I've ever heard of.
But you have heard of me.
A clip from Pirates of the Caribbean as we talk about the summer movie blockbuster with film critic Mike Mayo. Today is the anniversary of the one that started it all in 1975, Jaws.
And you can join in the conversation. Do you get excited about the big summer movies? What is your favorite summer blockbuster, past or present? Are they still making good blockbusting movies? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us. That address is talk@WPR.org.
And Mike, a clip from a more recent movie there. Do they still make them like they used to?
I don't think so. I think they have gotten too formulaic and too dependent on big computer-generated special effects. And for that, I think we can blame one of my own favorites, another Steven Spielberg movie, Jurassic Park. Mm. I think that really got us on the road to, you know, that was the first of the big special effects movie that showed dinosaurs with what has come to be called photorealism. You couldn't see any wires. There was no obvious stop motion, no back screen projection, any of the things that we normally see. Those dinosaurs looked as real as the people that were on the screen. And since now they can show anything with that degree of realism, we have the excesses of the Transformers and other things like that.
So when, in terms of the stories, technology is certainly a part of it. But, you know, we were thinking during the break, you know, Jaws, Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, those are some pretty new franchises at the time. And it seems like they have turned into franchises since then. Is part of this, too, just the ability to have a good story that's got some original thought to it? And what does that say about the state of the movie industry in terms of original thinking?
Well, when was the last really good original movie you saw that wasn't a sequel? I mean, I think you've hit it right there. And those three movies you mentioned are all good, solid stories, very well constructed with good characters that we come to identify with and believe in, no matter how fantastic the settings are. And the whole dramatic structure of them, the three-act structure that they've got is just absolutely rock solid. All of those go back to really good, talented writers who got things started, and the director kind of, you know, knew what they were doing and followed that, you know, to really tell that good story, not just the splashy effect that made you go wow, but that gives the whole movie that impact.
We'll go to our phones now at 800-642-1234 as we talk about summer movie blockbusters we love, or love to hate for that matter. We've got Christian on the line in Sun Prairie. Christian, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What's your summer blockbuster?
Indiana Jones, all the series, but those are my favorite growing up. But I had a question for you guys. I don't know, have you guys seen the last one, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
I did not.
Last one.
Yes, I saw it, and it was as other people have noted, the moment when Indiana Jones escapes the nuclear explosion in the refrigerator, that's jumping the shark. That's
yep. Well, I was curious for you guys. I wanted to know if you think he's going to make another movie based on the way it ended with him putting his hat back on.
What do you think, Mike?
I would be surprised. How much longer can Harrison Ford play that character? I mean, he's just, I think, getting too old.
Yeah, was there talk of a new young Indiana Jones incarnation?
Right.
Like that?
Remember, Shia LaBeouf was there as his son, and so, you know, I guess he could have. But I feel like the bloom is off that rose now, and they've really kind of done all of that they can do. I would say, if anyone was asking my advice, you know, take those ideas and create a new character who's like Indiana Jones, but is involved in different things, but bring that same spirit to it. Don't try to just, you know, drag a few more dollars out of the franchise.
Yeah, and what I was wondering about that, because you're seeing some old things come back. You know, there's that new Ninja Turtles film, for example, that is out, a summer blockbuster, if ever there was one. But, you know, some of these films, you think about Jaws, is almost old enough to be, redone.
Rebooted? Oh, no.
Right, rebooted. I mean, that's what we've been seeing so often here with Spider-Man, even with Jack Ryan, the Tom Clancy character. That's, you know, been done so often. I really don't see the point in it. I think we've gone, those movies have gotten so much more complicated. I really can't see how, even with great special effects, you could do Jaws any better than it's already been done. And we've seen so many killer sharks now that they really are kind of old hat.
Well, we saw a reboot earlier this year, way bigger than any shark. Let's give a listen.
In 1954, we awakened something.
Well, there's nuclear tests in the Pacific. Not tests.
They were trying to kill it.
It being Godzilla. Mike, did that one need a reboot?
I must admit, I enjoyed that on sort of a guilty pleasure level. And as I have always enjoyed the Godzilla movies on a guilty pleasure level, and I really kind of like the idea that some people criticize this, that this was a heftier, chunkier Godzilla than the early ones. And I think you need that body mass. If you're going to flatten San Francisco, you need to have, you know, the big tail and the big hips and all of that. So, yes, I thought this Godzilla did exactly what we needed a Godzilla movie to do. I'll bet we're going to see a whole lot more of them now, but and I can't say that that's a good thing.
You know, I don't want to get too awfully deep and philosophical here, but when you think of summer blockbusters, does the climate of the time sort of influence the blockbuster, or is it the other way around, where the blockbuster kind of influences the culture?
Ooh, now that is a very interesting question, because when we started talking about this, I was thinking about another of my favorite summer blockbusters from back in 96, Independence Day.
Oh, yeah.
And I just remember the excitement that was built around that. We'd been seeing the ads for it for months. And to me, that was a movie that delivered, but at the time we weren't involved in any wars. We could take mass destruction a bit more frivolously, I suppose. And so when we see that kind of mass destruction done now, we don't take it quite the same way. Even Godzilla, as we were just talking about, though it was kind of fun, it simply didn't work for me in the same way that Independence Day did.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Dan on the line in Menominee. Hi, Dan.
Well, hi there. So speaking about reboots, especially the Godzilla reboot, I was very much against these for a very long time, especially the Spider-Man one, which seemed like it just wasn't enough time.
Agreed.
Well, but then I realized that I have seen at least six different iterations of A Midsummer Night's Dream in theater. And each one was just a retelling of the story, and so I'm starting to look at these movies as sort of our modern-day folktales. And so when you talk about reboots, it might just kind of be a new author's take on it. And so we can sort of, I don't want to say pick and choose, but I guess that's what I'm advocating. And so now instead of, you know, being all spiky and angry and nerd ragey about reboots, I'm kind of looking forward to them.
Dan, thank you. What an interesting perspective. What do you think of that, Mike?
I think there's a lot of validity to that. I mean, think about how many cinematic versions we have seen of the Three Musketeers, going all the way back to Silent Days. I think every generation kind of rediscovers that story. They're interesting characters. It's a good, solid plot, but open to adaptation in a lot of different ways. My favorite version of that is the one that comes from the 70s, directed by Richard Lester. But the newer ones have been very popular with younger audiences, and I would not be surprised if before long we don't see another one, because it's been a long time since we've had something like that. And yes, it is a folktale for you know, in popular entertainment terms.
So as we approach the top of the hour, I got a couple of questions here. One, what is a summer blockbuster that didn't really bust any blocks but is underappreciated in your book?
Oh, wow.
And if that doesn't work, what's your favorite one of all time?
Favorite one of all time would have to be Jurassic Park, simply because I saw that at a really great down to the Uptown Theater in Washington, D.C., which is one of the great big screen theaters with a full house full of kids that were all just as terribly frightened by the whole thing in all the right ways. And so that just the movie-going experience of that really has stuck with me over the years. As to one that is unfairly judged, nothing comes to mind right off the top of my head. I can't think of any that I really liked that I thought, boy, this should have done better with the public than it did.
All right, we'll leave it there for now, Mike. Thank you for joining us. Always a lot of fun.
Thanks for inviting me, guys. Like I said, this is one of my favorite topics.
That was movie critic Mike Mayo. His recent books include The Horror Show Movie Guide and the novel Jimmy the Stick.